I'm not going to give any presentation. I've already done that, so. Any comments or questions?
Yes. As you know, I have been a part of EC and benefited from you and from EC so much over the years because you are uniquely evangelical. And in starting Soul Force, I chose another way. Using Gandhi's paradigm, it says, we want you here working with us, representing your faith community with clarity and with precision and with commitment. If you're going to be a Christian among us, please be one. If you're going to be an evangelical, be one. But you're welcome here if you're not. And we get a lot of people who come into Soul Force meetings, especially large meetings, that are really don't like it that we don't sing the blood songs. And except as an exception now and then, because we have that kind of meeting going on. Are you ashamed of us? Do you wish us dead?
Well, you know, just before we turned this on, I was mentioning something that I started in 71, the Homosexual Community Counseling Center, which was certainly no Christian organization. And I'll repeat this for the tape. We put out a holiday card and, you know, decided not to put anything Christian on it, you know, because it was not, that's not what it was about. And so I think that, you know, one can start any kind of an organization and have a mission statement about that and have a purpose and parameters, and that's great. Certainly, our mission in Evangelicals Concerned is not the same as Soul Force, nor is Soul Force's mission the same as Evangelicals Concerned. And you can do some things that and reach some people that we don't, and vice versa. It was interesting, there was a man who came up to me at lunchtime and said that he was very appreciative of what I said because he never identified as evangelical. He always identified as a liberal Protestant. But somebody invited him to come here, and so he came. And he now has to start to question his own theology. And because he said that what I was saying about the evangelical faith was challenging him to rethink where he was coming from, which was not at all one of the ideas that I had in mind in presenting what I did, you know. So you never know what is going to be the fruit of the feedback.
Without getting into discussion, one more comment from me is that I've learned two things by being an interfaith ecumenical group. That one, I have more chance to be downright evangelical in that context, because so many people wander in without any real commitment to their faith. It's just generic. Mm-hmm. And so I've had more chance to talk about Christ and the cross in the context of why we're doing justice, mm-hmm. what the cross means. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a really good thing for witness, because people have come without expecting it. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, I really believe that in dealing with the injustice, that the wider we reach our arms, the more variety of people we work with, the more community we build with people of other faiths and of other views of the Christian church, the more chance we get to feed the poor and hungry and do justice work. But it's very difficult to not have that wider base on some issues. That the evangelical world is just so busy often. Let's just say that for me, I see EC as being somebody who helps those who are suffering. That you provide a safe space for evangelicals to come and be renewed and to be accepted and to see themselves. And in terms of doing justice, that's cutting off that suffering at its source. And I don't think EC has a whole justice division. or who is working overtly at that so much as you're working at helping those who suffer. And I've been hoping that evangelicals concerned could get people past that stage where all they want to do is sit around and sing and be accepted and get out into that world where change needs to be take place so that we could push them to you when they're coming out, but they wouldn't come to me when they're coming out and say, how come you're not singing the blood songs? Let them sing the blood songs in EC. I'm being very coarse.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with a lot of what you've just said.
I know you wouldn't.
I think that the ministry of EC is a lot broader than a safe place. As a matter of fact, the phrase, this is a safe place, has always rubbed me the wrong way. Because I don't think that we're necessarily looking for a safe, we should be looking as Christians for a safe place. Christianity is not a safe place. You know, there's a great picture in the Narnia stories where Mrs. Beaver is explaining to the children about Aslan's coming. And they say, well, is Aslan safe? And Mrs. Beaver says, of course he's not safe, but he's good. So I don't think that EC is supposed to be a safe place where everybody's little, pet desires and prejudices and forth are coddled or anything like that. But, and I certainly think that we have a justice division in our ministry. I think that one of the founding purposes of EC, and has been true all along, is to reach out as an educational ministry to the evangelical community to show them what homosexuality is and is not, and so forth. And to that end, we have sent Record and Review out to, as I say, 2,000 libraries and individuals around the country and for all these years to try to upgrade the understanding. And then as the understanding gets upgraded, there is less of a need for people to find a, quote, safe place someplace else, you see, and so forth. So I think there's a place for Soul Force, certainly, and a place for EC. But I don't see EC. I think the ministry of EC must be more and more a ministry of helping evangelical Christians who find themselves to be gay-oriented to work through any problems they have with that so that they can get on with the business of living the Christian life undistracted by that. Mm-hmm. And then to help their families and pastors and that sort of thing, help them to integrate them into their communities. But what I find very discouraging is the bulk of the religious gay movement, where there is a revulsion, and quite properly so, given what Jesus said, to the gospel, and where a young woman told me the other day, she offered to play her music, play her guitar, and sing songs that she wrote at a gay church, and she was disinvited because she wanted to sing about Jesus. You know, that would be offensive to too many people here. So I make no apology for blood songs, and for what we do. I think we need to do more of it. I think, quite frankly, the liberal church, having rejected the gospel, doesn't have much more than the ACLU's agenda.
Yeah.
And so that's what they do. And it's no skin off their teeth to be accepting of gay people. It's part of their thumbing their nose at their backgrounds. And so I'm quite myself bored by a great deal of the pro-gay liberal church. I just find it irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. Talk a lot about justice issues, but the ACLU is doing as good or better a job at it. Southern Poverty doing as good a job or better on it. That's my point. But anyway, something else. Yeah.
How do you, for those of us in the conservative churches where we're getting the anti-gay teachings, I just heard you say take this back and get it to the pastors. How do we get them to see the way that we see it, that God is all-inclusive?
Well, you don't do it by preaching at them. You do it by incarnation, by simply being there. Not even by making a lot of noise. If they don't want you to teach because they don't believe you should be teaching or singing in the choir, but you're there. And you're there with your partner or whatever. Your presence. And that's a presence for the preacher, who in many cases isn't ever going to be able to afford to change his mind for economic reasons. But you're there for the other people in the congregation to see, a silent witness. You have to take the long haul. As Michael said, when I was on the staff of InterVarsity 40 years ago, I spoke up at Yale and urged them to integrate evangelical faith and homosexuality. And I wasn't then permitted to stay on the board, but I wasn't fired on the spot. I completed that year's ministry with InterVarsity. I just wasn't reappointed. And and figured out that, well, I can't then get somebody else to pay me for doing this ministry, so I'll employ myself, you know, which I have done, paid my own way.
How did you come to your own realization on this issue?
Simply by taking the gospel seriously. The gospel, it doesn't come to a screeching halt just because of homosexuality. And that was clear to me when I was in high school. And I never really had a problem with it. And I think the more we help people to take the gospel seriously, that nothing trumps the gospel, that people can get then beyond their grievances with non-comprehending preachers or churches or parents and just move on and live their lives. Because if you don't, you get bogged down in somebody else's agenda.
I think as surprising as it seems and as amazing as it was to me, God is calling people within the churches that are evangelical and not accepting to stand up as a witness, as he has told me, and I'm amazed at that, to see a pastor, to talk to the gay community, to encourage, and it is a battle, but I think he is raising up a voice even among the evangelical non-gay community to speak for the gay community.
Oh, it is absolutely the case. Yes, and I think the evangelicals who are able to be more open and accepting are the ones who are heterosexual, for example, who don't have their own agenda to be dealing with. And more and more of them are, you know, as I was saying earlier. There are more evangelical leaders that I could invite to speak than there are good speakers among them. So, and I once, you know, thought, even on the writing of the reviews, you know, when I started writing these reviews back 30 years ago, I wondered, really, are there going to be enough books to review? You know, now, of course, there are far too many to review. People ask me if I've reviewed such and such and such and such, and, you know, just so much of it is just the same old thing from somebody else, you know. Of course, then people ask me to review things that I've already reviewed. I said, didn't you read? Yeah.
This is a question about the relationship between certainty and faith in the context of reconciling spirituality and sexuality, especially for people who became Christian or who grew up in a conservative fundamentalist churches. I think they carry with them a lot of the teaching that, from my personal experience, I've been to 4 Exodus conferences, and this is my first Connection conference. And I think the commonality among the 5 conferences is, in my heart, there's always a place that does not arrive at a 100% certainty, one way or the other.
Mm.
So, from your own experience and from the experience of your ministry, do you have 100% certainty? And if not, how do you reconcile that lack of 100% certainty with faith, that relationship between the uncertain world we live in?
Well, certainly I think that we walk by faith, not by sight. That's the way we're supposed to. Walk by faith, not by sight. And so faith itself is an experience something short of certainty. But the object in whom we place our faith is one that we faith is a certain truth. And we leave it at that. Now, I think that when it comes to homosexuality, you have to ask yourself, well, now, wait a minute. Why would there be any doubt to begin with? Because people who are heterosexual, they don't have that struggle. So what's the difference? Because for all practical purposes, they are identical. That is, you know, they are both experienced in the same way. They are derived from this in the same way. They are addressing the same needs, human needs, and so forth. So why is there a need, for example, for, you know, a certainty that the homosexual is right when there's not a need for the heterosexual right now? Of course, for some people there is. You know, for those people are very much troubled. But why is there a need for the certainty? Only because there has been some illegitimate questions raised. See, out of ignorance, out of misconceptions, out of stereotypical thinking about what homosexuality is and isn't, and so forth. So I can certainly see why, if the only thing that we knew about homosexuality, or the only thing a kid would know about his homosexuality, is what he sees on television during a gay pride parade or something like that, then there would be legitimate questions to raise. But if a person understands that the only difference is the anatomy or gender, if you will, of the object of the orientation, then this can be handled in a Christ-honoring way or a Christ-rejecting way. And this can be handled in a Christ-honoring way or a Christ-rejecting way. That the truth or the legitimacy or the rightness of either the heterosexual expression or the homosexual expression is not about the orientation. The rightness is whether or not the orientation is lived out in the other welfares, the other person's welfare and love and so forth, or not, in either direction. And then get on with the living as loving a relationship as two people can put together. That is appropriate to the orientation in which they find themselves. And not make a big deal. You know, we are not saved by our homosexuality, which is news to a lot of gay religionists. And we are not saved by our ex-homosexuality, which is news to a lot of Exodus people. And nobody is saved by his or her heterosexuality, which they just woke up one day and recognized was there.
Ralph, doesn't it help to also acknowledge that you are a victim, Paul, of misinformation? And like any cultic victim, if you study, for example, Jim Jones and those who escaped it, they carried with them this tremendous sense of uncertainty for a long time, even though it was totally certain anybody looking on that Jones was wrong. And that if you realize that there is some kind of residue of all that misinformation that you can kind of be comfortable with it as it wears away. You kind of say, that's that old stuff coming back. I'm free of it, but it's still there a little, and it'll wear away. But it will be there for a while, won't it? It certainly has been for me.
See, there again is why I think that the gospel is so great. Because I think that one of the problems for people who have gotten into a certain kind of fundamentalism, which is not synonymous with evangelical faith, a kind of cocksure fundamentalism, or a cocksure Jim Jones cultic thing, or even a cocksure Exodus mentality, or a cocksure rainbow coalition mentality. They're all fundamentalists. They all have to be right, and somebody else has to be wrong. And so that really reinforces the need, the experiential sense of need. I don't mean the real need, but an experiential sense of need. But I have to be sure. Everybody who was at Jonestown was sure. Of course, they weren't really sure. They had to convince themselves they were sure, because nobody is sure. They're whistling in the dark. They're whistling in the dark in Jonestown. They're whistling in the dark in the GLBT, XYZ, PPQQ, whatever. And they're whistling in the dark at the ex-gay conferences. The only place you don't have to whistle in the dark is in the light of the gospel, because that is grace. You don't have to be sure. You have to say, Lord, it's in your hand. And I'm just going to then live the life that I can see I'm supposed to live in terms of loving you with all my heart and my neighbor as myself, and that's a full-time job. And all this other stuff, I don't have to figure out. See? And that's the difference between every little rigid groups, statements of belief and where you have to be, and the gospel. God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. That is the liberating message. Any other message of liberation, so-called, pales into insignificance to that. The world isn't going to be saved once everybody in the church thinks gay people are swell. The world is still going to hell. Yes?
couple of questions. First of all, what do you feel is where the fundamentalists get off and what fuels their animosity to this case?
Well, a couple of things. It's not only fundamentalism. Who was prepared for homosexuality? Who here was prepared for homosexuality? How long did it take you? And you had an internal voice saying, oh, no, 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 it's not this and it's not this. What kind of internal navigation did so many fundamentalists have about homosexuality? All they knew is what you do, they do, that is, they just extrapolated from what they like to do or attempted to do or want to do or don't want to do. That's what all of us do too, don't they? I say, well, why would anybody want to do that? Right? And one of the ways you can kind of get into their head, into the fundamentalist's head, about why in the world would anybody want to do something homosexual, is not to think of somebody that you're sexually attracted to. Think of somebody of the same gender that you're not sexually attracted to. See? And think then of, ooh, if only I could get in bed with him or her. You see? Have I lost you? Are you thinking? See? Now you say, well, why would I want to do that, right? You get it? Well, that's the way the fundamentalist thinks. Why would anybody want to do that? Now they have some proof texts, but there are proof texts about a lot of things. So their biggest problem is just one of going inside, like we all do, and coming up with, ugh. And just taking what is understood in the general consensus. I mean, goodness sakes, well-educated people, even people in my profession at one time thought that all homosexuals are sick, you know. I remember my good friend Ernst Vandenhag way back in the late 60s and 70s saying that some of his fellow psychoanalysts would say, Ernst, all of my homosexual patients are sick. And he says, well, my heterosexual patients are sick. You know? Why would they be coming to see me if they weren't sick? So when all you know is a particular bit of information, then you can come up with all kinds of ideas, you see? So it's not strange that people were unprepared for homosexuality. Now, I think today, there's no excuse to continue in a lot of that ignorance and stuff like that. But then, there are economic considerations to be taken into consideration. You can name the ministers of the biggest fundamentalist churches in America. If suddenly it dawned on them that they'd been wrong about homosexuality and they came out in the pulpit and said so, they'd be out on their ear. These are economic considerations, and they have kids to put through college. So, you know, and the same way with, you know, Unitarian ministers. If suddenly the Unitarian minister, you know, decided, hey, you know, there's something to this gospel, and told his congregation that, he'd be out on his ear. There are economic and social, and all the people we went to school with, they're in my circle, and all the people that we hang around with, they're in my circle, right? And unfortunately today, in a more and more polarized society, you know, practically every precinct in America now is a landslide precinct. Because people just live with the people who think the same way they do. They go to church with the same kind of people, and they read only the same things. And they, you know, some people watch only Fox News, and some people watch only CNN, and some people read only the New York Times and the Washington Post, and some people or read only the Washington Times. And I saw there was a thing done where they traced people who bought books on Amazon, all the left-wing books were bought by all the same people that bought this book, I bought this book, none of them bought any books over here. And the same thing over here, all the right-wing book people, book buyers, they all bought and read only this stuff, never read anything over here. So fundamentalists don't understand people outside of their churches, and people, the media certainly doesn't understand fundamentalism. You know, the secular, atheistic, left-wing media does not understand Christianity. My goodness, he sounds like a right-winger. I'm just telling you like it is.
Left-wing media?
Absolutely.
Please.
Absolutely.
That used to...
No, it's still true.
Fox.
That's the thing. People always just keep saying that one. All the rest are someplace else.
Yeah, not listened to. I mean, the right-wing media is really in its ascendancy.
Yeah.
One of the questions is, Freud came out with, he wrote a letter to a mother about her homosexual son, and he said homosexual is not anything to be worried about. And why didn't all these American psychologists and stuff pick up on that and run with it? Instead, they went the conservative route, which the churches all have, for the anti-gay, like Nicolosi and all, or Nicolai, whatever that one.
Nicholas.
You know, picked up and, you know, and continue this thing that they have, but they didn't do the thing with Freud, you know.
Well, because that you're referring to was written by Freud in a private letter to a mother. It was in total contrast to what Freud said in his published writings about homosexuality. So Freud thought that homosexuals were sick.
Well, why the difference?
Because you say to a dear mother what you think the dear mother wants to hear. And she published the letter. No, Freud thought all homosexuals were sick, and therefore all the psychoanalysts who followed Freud thought they were sick. And now, the fundies and the ex-gay people, who never had any time for Freud, and psychoanalysis, you know, atheist and all kinds of stuff like that, now, for a certain face validity, they are using some of the same terminology as the psychoanalytic, which is now passé in the mental health field, but it has a certain face validity that just, you know, turned over to Jesus doesn't quite have the same cachet as Oedipal complexes and so forth. What?
That's going against Jay Adams and some of his going against that type of counseling.
Well, of course, Jay Adams. Did you know, I knew Jay Adams before he was Jay Adams.
Well, I know where he comes from, but I'm just saying that, you know, some of what he's...
Jay Adams. When I was a student in university, and this was in such long ago days that they had Religious Emphasis Week, REW Week. Who here remembers that? Anyway, I had helped to start a church of evangelical Presbyterians, and there was a battle for our congregation between about three different evangelical Presbyterian denominations, and Jay Adams was the national secretary for church planting for the Bible Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod out in St. Louis, which is developed into Covenant Seminary and so forth. And so he was just a young guy in his 20s, and so I invited him to come be the Religious Emphasis Week. So his very first little book, Realized Millennialism, with the little crown on it and everything, you know, he wrote to my dear friend Ralph Blair.
Oops.
And then he went on to start Noethetic Counseling, which he had no background to do. But so that was Jay Adams. But no, he's not friendly to psychoanalytic. Yeah.
I'm having a little problem lately separating my politics from my spirituality, in that I know that Jesus is my my God. And that that takes the place and is preeminent. On the other hand, politically, lately, I'm irritated at straight people being able to have a vote in my rights. I don't join the cause because I think my anger, and you're talking a little bit maybe about pathological, and I think I might be there. I don't know that I can march peacefully. I don't know that I can go out there and be nice about it, because I watch, and I do watch the news, and I think, why does someone have that right? How do you deal with the anger and still trust in the Lord? Because you seem to handle it. You're peaceful about stuff.
Well, it's known as democracy.
But you it's know. My rights, not theirs.
Well, no. I mean, in democracy, they vote and you vote, and if their votes are greater than your votes, then they have their way. That's the way it works. Now, the important thing is not to personalize. See, don't personalize the opposition to gay people. Now, some of you, I think, are thinking, well, that's easier said than done, right? Don't personalize it? No. I mean by don't personalize it, don't locate in your own sense of self the reason why they're doing it. See? Because that's not why they're doing it. They haven't consulted either, even their sense of you, let alone your sense of you. See, and what I hear behind a lot of what you're saying is you're feeling hurt. Well, no. You're feeling hurt.
Okay.
Feeling hurt, and then to cope with the feeling hurt, you get angry.
Yeah.
That's what people do. We get frustrated, and then we raise our voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
We get angry. We feel hurt, and then we get angry, right? See? People always talk about, I have a right to my anger, right? Do you ever hear anybody say, I have a right to my hurt? I have a right to my frustration? You know? I have a right to my fear? Nobody has claims to have a right to any unwanted feeling except not the primary anger that comes from the idea that I need it to be otherwise, but from the retaliative anger, which is hostility. Damn you, you know, that kind of anger. But if you don't personalize their opposition, you know, they're exercising, they're sincere, you know, they really do think that it's wrong. I don't have any problem believing that most of them are sincere. I mean, who would get up in the morning and do a lot of this stuff out of anything other than sincerity? See? So, I mean, some people maybe make some money on it, but most people are sincere. They're simply sincerely, from my point of view, sincerely wrong. But they have a right to be wrong. But I don't have to hold myself hostage to their intelligence. See? Or their understanding. And I will marshal my forces to try and, you know, get out the vote against what they're going to vote for and that sort of thing. Do what I can. But I'm not going to get myself all bent out of shape over what I can't change. That's a lot of wasted energy and time and effort. There's much better things to be done with my time. See? So then it doesn't boil my blood. But it doesn't get me to just sit on my butt either. You know? But it does help me do the long haul thing without getting burned out. Tried to explain to somebody last night about burnout, didn't quite get it.
I'll punch him. I'll let you tell me it was a solution.
Okay, quote your misunderstanding. We were talking about burnout. What how can you overcome burnout? And I said,
never assign yourself the responsibility, wasn't the word, the assignment, to accomplish, never assign yourself to accomplish a task that you have to, that someone else has to have you finish, complete.
Now you understand why he hasn't been able to put it into practice.
He's starting to burn out.
I told him I'm out this morning, I couldn't eat breakfast because somebody else had to prepare it. He says, no, you missed it. So.
You'll never suffer burnout if you keep in mind that you give yourself assignments to do only that which you can originate, only your part on the committee. If in order for the committee to reach its goal, everybody on the committee has to do his or her job, and some don't, then it's not going to get done. And there's no reason for you to burn yourself out over that, because you've done your part. But in order for the thing to be accomplished, everybody had to do his or her part, and they didn't, so that's it. And you can move on and then get on another committee. Instead, what people do is, never getting on a committee again, well, that's the most frustrating thing, you know. I'm just burned out. I'm finished with this people. I'm not going to get on another church committee as long as I live. See? Well, that's all unnecessary. Now, who here understands it better than Mel?
Say the sentence. The sentence of the paradigm. Never.
I said, never give yourself the assignment to take full responsibility for what it requires, by definition, a group of people all acting together to accomplish.
It was very...
If you say it in Chinese, it will make more sense.
It was very late at night.
And we were having way too much fun.
Yes, we were. Yes.
We're burning out at the end of the day.
Yeah.
In outside of our churches, our church environments and so forth, we talk about being a silent witness as the best in the long, for the long haul. Can we apply that in secular circles, in our everyday lives?
Oh yeah.
As a way.
Oh yes, yes, I think so. I mean, most of my clients over the years have been atheistic Jews. But over the time, some of them even have become Christians, you know, because they saw something there, and then they start to think, my goodness, you know, this cognitive therapy that we deal with, you know, a lot of it goes back to the Bible and stuff like that. But I don't tell them, well, now here's the chapter and verse for what's wrong with you. But you know, I think that the more people come out to their families and are incarnational witnesses in families and in churches, not running away from good home church. They teach good Bible classes and everything, but they just have a blind spot about the homosexuality. Well, okay, continue to have your relationship, and you're sitting there in the church and so forth, but you're carrying on yourself. But the more that happens, the more people are going to have to say, you know, the idea that we have in our heads isn't right. And it'll happen with gay people as it happened with divorce. Randy Balmer, who's the editor-at-large for Christianity Today, who was our Eastern Connection speaker, had a very fundamentalist father. He was a preacher all of his life. And Randy became a minister, and Randy got his PhD and teaches religion and history of religion, American religion, at Columbia University. And Randy's father, fundamentalist preacher that he was all these years, always took pride in the fact that he had never married a couple that ever got divorced. And then at the end of his life, a couple years left to live, his son Randy got a divorce. And just shortly after that, he came down with cancer, and he was very sick the last couple of years of his life. And the woman to whom Randy is now married, but was his girlfriend, just before Randy's father died, that woman asked Randy's father, "Would you please marry us?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "Yes." Mm-hmm. And then he died before he had to do that. But that, you know, I think is an important indication. Look at the way the churches have changed on divorce. And the same Bible verses are there in the Bible. Same Bible verses are there. And yet, there are people in pulpits and on church committees and so forth in evangelical churches who have been through divorce. And because it's in their families, you know. I mean, I'm involved with the ministry of a very outstanding evangelical leader. His daughter just got a divorce. I mean, it's happening, you know, in people's families. And so it has an influence on the way you think, you know. In the same way with all kinds of other, you know, years ago, they used Bible verses to support slavery or to support segregation. Now, those Bible verses are still there in the Bible, but nobody pays them any mind. One day nobody's going to be paying any mind to the clobber passages.
Amen.
See? Who knows what's going to be the next thing, but, you know. Yes. Yeah, and both of you.
Do you foresee a day when either a prominent evangelical leader or a Catholic pope comes out affirming gay and Christianity, being gay and Christian at the same time?
A prominent
evangelical leader or a Catholic pope.
Yeah, forget the Catholic pope. It's just too political. But what about the prominent evangelical leader? What?
Coming out and saying that Christian and gay are compatible.
Oh, it's already been happening for years. Where do you think I get the speakers? Now this year here we had a couple of people who happened to be gay. But many years the speakers are not gay. We have evangelical leaders. Nick Walterstorff, who is, I don't know if you guys, anybody here ever hear of Nick Walterstorff? See, you have to be like on the 700 Club or something like that to be. But Nick Walterstorff is the dean of evangelical Christian philosophers in not only this country but around the world. Totally supportive of us. So is his wife, who's an Episcopal priest, Claire Walterson. Peggy Campolo is an evangelical leader.
Campolos are definitely.
Well, not Tony. Not Tony. Not Tony. I mean, listen, Tony sends people to us, and you know, it's not a thing.
Tony's a threat.
But Lou Smeads, who just died last year.
Yes.
As I said, even after he spoke at both of our conferences, Fuller Seminary, through the board, and a board of a seminary like Fuller, you know, is a bunch of conservative business people, right?
Yes.
And they passed a resolution to establish the Lewis B. Smeads Memorial Chair of Christian Ethics there at Fuller. And after he had published on this, being supportive. And Christianity Today, as I say, gave an award to his book, his memoirs, posthumously published, as one of the top 10 evangelical books of the year. And Rosalind Rinker came out, and you know, and the name probably doesn't mean a lot to you, but she She wrote books on conversational prayer. Even the idea of conversational prayer was something that she developed. And Eugenia Price, who here has ever read any of her books, The Wider Place and all that stuff? She was totally supportive. And
I heard she was bisexual.
Hmm?
Somebody said she was bisexual.
Mm-mm. She was a lesbian.
Oh.
And you know, and this coming year in the East, we have Rita Halteman Finger, who teaches New Testament at Messiah College in Pennsylvania. Oh. You know, and she's totally supportive of us. Walt Hearn, we're having him out east next year, the same one. And he lives here in Berkeley, and for many years he edited the journals for the American Scientific Affiliation, which is the organization for evangelicals in science.
Evangelicals at Berkeley? That's
evangelicals in science, yeah. And so Walt Hearn has been supportive. And so, I mean, you just go through the names of all the people that have been keynoters at EC, you know.
Are you having next year here?
I have the male speaker confirmed. I don't have the female, so I usually like to announce them both together. But you'll love it.
Okay.
But you see what I'm saying? That they're already there.
But some of you aren't recognized by some of the fundamental, you know, evangelical.
Well, I can't be responsible for your keeping abreast.
some of the other, you know.
Well, like, who did you have in mind?
Jerry.
That everybody would know.
Oh, Jerry Falwell. Yeah, right.
I would say someone in the caliber of Billy Graham. But, you know,
well, there's only one Billy Graham. There's nobody in the caliber of Billy Graham. Well, he's the man of the century, and so forth.
Not quite up to the help of doing something, I don't think.
No. But you have to appreciate the fact that there are other evangelical leaders besides Billy Graham.
It's a growing movement, as you're
saying. I mean, we have had people from the faculties of evangelical schools like Calvin College and, as I say, Messiah College, and it's not the first time, Messiah, Hope College,
Messiah did a big treatise on H.A., Homosexuals Anonymous. H.A. linked their website through Messiah.
No, not Messiah. There is a professor at Messiah that has been supportive of that.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
When earlier you were illustrating, talking about the fundamentalists at a cocksure and kind of going through. So, listening to that, if we think of a fundamentalist as far right or whatever that means, as looking left and saying, I'm cocksure that this is holier ground or holy ground or maybe holier ground I'm standing on than you, and then the ex-gay people are looking left and right and saying, well, I'm on holier ground than you, and it seems like you have evangelicals in the middle, and what keeps us from being cocksure and saying,
well, see,
my ground is...
This is why I was trying to say, we're not on the middle. We're not in the middle. We cast our lot with the cross, with the gospel. Some people will cast their lot with left-wing politics or left-wing religion, some with right-wing politics or right-wing religion, some with gay and proud, and some with ex-gay. Evangelicals cast their lot with Christ and the gospel, and the gospel of grace. And we're all over the map when it comes to various theological questions. You know, I mean, you cannot think there's a very interesting book. If I pull this out here, I get the exact title of it. To show the wide variety in evangelical theology. And I think a lot of times, maybe, you know, quite innocently, a lot of people aren't aware of this sort of a thing, if I can just quickly find it here. Yes. There's a book called Across the Spectrum, published by Baker Books. Baker is an evangelical press publisher in Grand Rapids. And it's co-edited by Paul Eddy and Gregory Boyd. And it's called Across the Spectrum. And there's a chapter on each of the many different theological questions. They don't deal with homosexuality, but with many questions of basic theology about which evangelicals take different points of view. Everything. All kinds of stuff. So you mustn't write large your own little background in a particular fundamentalist church or something like that and think that speaks for all of evangelical faith, because it doesn't. And not only is there a wide variety in evangelical theology, but certainly in forms of worship and forms of government and all sorts of things like that. But they all come together around the cross, something that you don't see happening a lot, if at all, when a lot of liberal religionists come together, because they do not come together around anything other than their liberal agenda or their liberal mindset. See, evangelicals are not of a conservative mindset. I mean, Randy Balmer is politically quite left. You know, he was recommending that our people listen to Air America. You know, so by my goodness, you know, how conservative can he be? See, but theologically he's evangelical. You see.
Wouldn't you say that fundamentalists would say that they too are casting their lot with the cross? And
well, they might say that, but I think that you have to then, when you examine the documents, are they, or is it really, legalism and so forth, you see? So I think you have to, you just can't take what somebody says. You have to examine it, with an intelligent historical perspective. I mean, fundamentalism is not a historic branch of Christian faith. I mean, not a really historic branch of Christian faith. Fundamentalism came out of the 1920s as a reaction against modernism in the Protestant Church. And there was a good reason to be against a lot of what was passing for Protestantism in the 1920s. But fundamentalism arose as a protest against that and hooked on to certain things like the virgin birth and evolution and then started to build Bible institutes as over against colleges and, you know, that sort of thing, and a separatist mentality and so forth. So that's really what fundamentalism is. It shouldn't be confused. You know, some people today are speaking about fundamentalism across the world and across history as though there's Islamic fundamentalism and Christian fundamentalism. That's ridiculous. It is not historically sensitive to what actually is the history of religions. There's no similarity between Islamism and Jerry Falwell's fundamentalism, you know, that sort of a thing. Yeah.
I asked my family group last night whether they consider homosexuality a gift, and all of them said essentially because they are gay, they have to endure a lot of stuff, and that made them a better person, that they're able to understand God's heart, etc. So I'm just wondering for you, other than that, like through suffering, refining the character, is homosexuality, do you consider homosexuality a gift? And also just as the church become increasingly accepting of gay people, so the suffering part, unfortunately or fortunately, will go away one day. So how would that change the whole movement?
Well, I think a Christian point of view is that suffering can be redemptive, you know, and so we can think of it as a gift, but I get a little queasy when I think of people talking about either themselves as gifts to the world or some aspect of themselves as a gift. But certainly, you know, what doesn't do you in makes you stronger is the old idea, you know. And so what doesn't kill you, you know, you get better at. And so I think that a lot of the things, I mean, for example, no doubt when you all first noticed that you were gay, you weren't too happy about it. You know, you first concluded that this is where you are. And yet, look around you. You wouldn't have met these lovely people if you had, you know, and you wouldn't be in the relationship that you're in, or you wouldn't have some of the, and some of you wouldn't even have had the same strong Christian faith, you know, because maybe I think some people have gotten into a deeper Christian faith because they've had to wrestle with some things, you know. I think there are a lot of flabby heterosexuals. And I don't mean just physically. I think there are a lot of, whenever everything has seemed to go one's way, that doesn't make one a very strong person very often. And then the first little thing that comes along that doesn't go that person's way, the person isn't prepared for it, you know, that sort of thing. So, by the way, I was just thinking along the lines of the question that you asked earlier. I think that one of the big differences between the keynoters over the years at EC conferences and the keynoters at Exodus conference, I notice, is that more and more the keynoters at Exodus conferences are various leaders in ex-gay groups, you know, in this town or that sort of a thing. But they are not evangelical leaders who are heterosexual, who have other things going on in their lives, like we have, you know. I mean, where are the Lou Smeads and the Nick Walterstorffs and the Rosalind Rinkers and Eugenia Prices and these kinds of people who have ever spoken at Exodus? Now, they do have, a few. The guy was at the Lexington Chapel up in Massachusetts. What was his name? He spoke one year, but I think that is telling too.
Yeah.
That there's a kind of I don't think I want to get identified with that. Yeah.
Okay, with Massachusetts making the marriages legal, do you see that as a positive acceleration of that kind of thing happening, or do you see a backlash? And how do you see it affecting the church's view of homosexuality?
Oh, everything is give and take, you know. I mean, you can never get too far ahead of where the people are. Because there will always be a backlash. And if you get too far ahead, the backlash can be very bad. So you always have to, you know, two steps ahead and one step back to make sure that, you know, now is that where we want to be and that sort of thing. So it doesn't, you know, I think it's all instructive and, you know, I'm certainly in favor of it. But as you can see, when it goes too, you know, what some people would consider too far, then that gets the drums rolling for an effort to, you know, roll it back. So it's always going to be a tug of war. But the only way that it moves beyond that is when the people themselves have moved. See, I mean, people at large have moved beyond slavery. So there's no tug of war. And by and large, people have moved beyond segregation. But certainly, by and large, people have not moved beyond the homosexual thing. So long as that is going on, it's going to be give and take, and going to, you know, win some, lose some, and so forth, all along. But that's fine. You know, I don't think anybody here would want to live in a country where the the leadership that made the rules, you know, the judges or whatever, were too far ahead of everybody else, because then you have a revolution on your hands, you know. Yeah.
Which is why I think your message today is so important, that we need to recognize where our help comes from, because as we talked about just a little bit earlier, if the people will not follow a leader into truth, if the congregations would not follow a leader into acceptance of all people, then it's not necessarily the leader's fault.
No.
That it is the people who are not keeping an eye on who their God is.
Right.
And what he is asking of them. And that's an important lesson for us.
Yes.
That we need to be keeping our eyes
yes.
on God.
I think that you also have to recognize that, you know, people tend to go to churches where they hear what they want to hear. And that's true for conservative churches, liberal churches, and so forth. Right? So, again, how much progress can be made if people avail themselves of only one message?
So on that note, over your years of watching different people reconcile with their families or their churches or their community, Sherry and I were really early in that process because we just accepted ourselves 2 years ago. So we acknowledge that there's got to be space for our family, but this concept of going back to church that asked us to leave at some point, or do you just continue to live openly and out in the church and community and work your place now, or your family has been pretty clear they're not comfortable? Is there tips or wisdom from people that you have watched or coached over the years as how we can effectively live openly, Christianizing, you know?
Well, I think that if people have actually kicked you out and so forth, well then, you know, as Jesus said, you know, you shake off the dust of your shoes, you know, and leave until they're ready to apologize or bring you back or, you know, something like that. But for you to just, you know, go in and worship at a church that, if the first thing they knew about you were that you were gay, you know, then that might force them to make some decisions, you know, call a board meeting and, you know, what is this about? But if they just see, you know, a couple of women coming in and worshiping and singing and so forth and get to know you, it's always harder to then deal with a real human being as a stereotype than it is to deal with a stereotype as a stereotype, you know. So you just walk in and say, I'm homosexual. Am I going to be welcome here? You know, well, I don't think so. So I think you just have to kind of play it by ear and not put yourself into harm's way and all that, you know. But I mean, even a family that at first says, no, this isn't acceptable, but then they know that you've been living with each other and helping each other out, you know, through sickness and in health and all that kind of stuff. And then they can come around. No guarantee, but because, you see, they have a vested interest in doing so. Nobody kicks you out who's indifferent. Okay? Sometimes families kick you out in order to pressure you not to make such a dumb mistake. Is there something like that? Because of their ignorance, they don't even understand what's going on. So anybody who has had a strong reaction against you is not indifferent, and so long as people are not indifferent, they might grow. Yeah?
I would be interested in hearing you say some more about the incarnation in terms of connecting what they just said, the scenario of get to know our faces first, and then our and then the have the chance to be our sexual orientation. The connection between that and Jeremy Marx's comments about relationship first principles sometime after. And tying that together with I think of that as the incarnation. I know you've thought about incarnation, so I would be interested in hearing more.
I'm not sure what the question is, though.
Okay, that's fair. What are your thoughts? No, I won't. Let's see. Let me take a moment.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. I have a question about the relationship between the individual and the community. Because when I was listening to the question and the answer about Christian leaders, there's a part of me that say, well, I don't really care, because if it's true, one is enough. If it's not true, 100 is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess for
it's a good point.
For people who come, because in the macro environment is that if you don't think, if you don't do anything, you will just go with the flow in the church. So for people who get out, on some way they have to do some independent thinking and processing. But I guess for myself, I feel like it makes me vaguely suspicious. Like, this is my first connection.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came here the first night, I was just vaguely suspicious of everything. Because I just...
As well you should have been.
but I guess the danger, for people who jump out of that so-called mainstream is that there may be a potential risk of going to the other side where the self becomes the standard.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering if you have any tips on how to avoid the other extreme, and also how to evangelize people, i.e. a lot of gay people who are very self, kind of, I am the judge of my own life.
Yeah.
So this is a question both in terms of for people who are reconciling,
yes,
and for people who need to be evangelized.
Yes. Well, I think that one always has to be suspicious if, for example, if one thinks, well, I'm buying into this only because it's in my best interest, you know, I have a vested interest, self-interest, you know, in thinking that the Bible really isn't against homosexuals, because I'm a homosexual and I don't want to think that the Bible's against it. So there's a special interest here, see? And you think, well, that might be suspicious. On the other hand, the heterosexual, anti-gay preaching is also self-serving, and you know, so but of course very often they don't think of it as self-serving and so forth. And I think there's a good analogy in the what I want to say is repeat what I said before about the gospel trumping all ideologies, so that my little pet ideology doesn't get served by my interpretation of the homosexuality, but it's the gospel that interprets my homosexuality, not my homosexuality that interprets the gospel. And the illustration or the parallel that I want to present to you, and this is a very, very frequently misunderstood matter, and that is why the American Psychiatric Association changed the classification of homosexuality as a mental disorder back in 73. And the right wing, you know, puts out this stuff that it was all because a bunch of militant gay people, you know, disrupted the meetings and made a lot of noise and scared them to death, and they changed their minds and so forth. Did not happen. What happened was that the entire diagnostic and statistical manual of mental diseases was under revision. And, you know, the big red book, DSM-3 at that time, was, about that thick, you know. And every single mental disorder was up for revision by scientific committees to look at it. What is really the evidence, you know? Well, obviously we have to have a criterion. Does it stay? Does it get thrown out? And it can't be because the militant gays don't like it in there, or, you know, or the old school psychoanalysts want it, you know, in there because they have to buy their swimming pools and stuff like that. So, there was a scientific criterion established for the entire DSM, not just for homosexuality. And that, and it was a double-pronged scientific criterion, that in whatever is the mental disorder in question, in its full-blown manifestation, it had to meet these two criteria together, not one or the other, both. In its full-blown manifestation, which in the case of homosexuality would be, you know, you're homosexual and you're having a homosexual relationship and so on. In its full-blown manifestation, it had to be both socially dysfunctional and subjectively distressing. Now, anything that qualified for those two things together remained in the DSM. Anything that did not was thrown out. If homosexuality had been retained as a classification of mental disorder, it would have been the only classification in the entire fat DSM that would have not qualified. And it would have been retained because of some political pressure or something like that, but not science. Because obviously, you cannot say that invariably, in its full-blown manifestation, every single homosexual couple is socially dysfunctional, right? They have friends, they go to work, they accomplish things, they are professional leaders, you know, whatever. And so they're quite functional as people. And they're happy being together. You know, they're not subjectively distressed. Now, anything else that you want to go flipping through the DSM and say, well, now, if you have that, might you be subjectively distressed? Well, maybe not subjectively distressed, but you're certainly socially dysfunctional. You see, there's certain classifications like that, you know, sociopathology, or the other, the reverse, you know. Who would like to be diagnosed with any of those things in the DSM, you see? Don't you think that that wouldn't be fun? See? So what I'm saying is, if there is a criterion outside of the prejudices and the self-serving self-interest, just as in the classification in the DSM, of either the psychoanalysts on the one hand or the militant gays on the other hand, the same kind of thing with the homosexuality and the Bible, as it were, you know, instead of the DSM, the Bible, or Christian theology. What is it that is the focus of the Christian message? It's that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, except, of course, if you happen to develop as a homosexual, then Jesus wasn't here representing you. So the whole thing is called off if there is ever any nerve-ending juxtaposing. See? I mean, you can shake somebody else's hand, but you must not juxtapose these nerve endings with these nerve endings with somebody of the same gender, or else the whole plan of salvation comes crumbling down. And then you have to ask yourself, does that make sense? See? What kind of a feeble story of salvation is that? See? That what Jesus did on the cross is totally canceled out by two people who are gently living with each other. It just makes no sense. And it takes it out of the realm of, well, you know, you're sort of, you know, yeah, you read the clobber passages this way, and they, you know, and you inject gay theology, and, you know. No. I'm not talking about gay theology. Throw gay theology away. No such thing, you know. It's biblical theology, the cross. Yeah.
What's been the evolution of gayness being seen as what people do versus who they were created as? It seemed like that really irks certain groups when you say, well, that's how God created me, and they'd say, no, it's not. It's not who you are, it's a behavior that you do. So,
but that distinction, that distinction between being and doing is an artificial one. Because the people who use that do not make a distinction when it comes to heterosexuality. They say, yeah, okay, you're heterosexual. But that doesn't mean you have to do those terrible things to your wife.
Hmm.
You see. Just be heterosexual. And be celibate. Or better yet, get married to a person of the same sex. You see?
So the scientific community has always been that homosexuals are homosexuals, or that homosexuals, they were homosexuals because they did homosexual things?
Well, I mean, it depends on when you're talking about, you know, the history of the understanding of homosexuality. But I mean, there was a time, I mean, even Kinsey, you know, I mean, the famous 10% of Kinsey's study wasn't rooted in the idea of homosexual orientation. The scale, the Kinsey scale, was not developed on the basis of orientation. It was developed on the basis of frequency of orgasms. See, and then because he, you know, interviewed in prisons, obviously it got skewed to, you know, 10% of men are, you know, exclusively homosexual. When what he actually found is 10% of the men that he interviewed, all of their orgasms were homosexually prompted, you know, same sex. So this matter of being and doing is something that needs to not be kept apart. But, you know, if you are, then the behavior is going to flow from who you are, as it always is. If you're a Christian, then your behavior is going to be Christian. And if you're just nominally Christian, or you don't pay any serious attention to your Christianity, then you can't say that the behavior that you engage in is going to flow from that, from those allegiances and that discipleship and so forth. And the same thing is true of anything else. Yeah.
Yesterday in your relationship workshop, you were talking about America being a sex-negative society.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the world was at one point. Why do you think that other countries have moved beyond that? America has been stuck in that sex negative.
Well, I didn't say that other countries have moved beyond sex negativity.
You
I said that America.
Have.
What?
You didn't say that, but I think a lot have.
What nation has moved beyond sex negativity?
I think a lot of European nations.
What nation? You mean like Scandinavian nation?
I think they're a lot more accepting of sexuality and sex in general than America is.
I don't think so. The reason I don't think so is that I think what you're confusing as acceptance is engaging in a lot of genital activity with a lot of different people. That is not an integration of sexuality into the rest of one's life. You know, in other words, the more sex, you know, I mean, some people say, well, you haven't accepted your homosexuality because you don't go to the baths or something. I mean, actually, I was told that by gay religion leaders in early on when I started EC, and I used to be invited, because I started the Homosexual Community Counseling Center, I used to be invited to be keynoters at various things, and at gay religion retreats and stuff like that. But then in the Q&A, and I would point out the irrationality of promiscuity, then I would be told, well, you just haven't accepted your homosexuality, you know, and you're uptight, and you mean you never go to the baths, and, you know. See, that is not acceptance of sexuality. That is the exact opposite, psychologically speaking. But they were too dull up here to get it. So I didn't waste my breath. Like the Scots say, save your breath to cool your porridge. And so I just, you know, but I was never invited back.
So what takes us from sex negative to sex positive?
Integration. In other words, you know, you wouldn't say, boy, you know, this guy has really accepted his gastronomical side. He just gorges on Big Whoppers and stuff like that, you know. And this other guy over here who watches what he eats and, you know, eats in moderation and, you know, he just never has learned about the goodness of food. I mean, sort of that kind of thing. So, anyway, I think we're about time to finish, so bye-bye.